what we've been doing, you know, our goal for the past week has been to calculate the two-point function, which I think we've probably done in enough detail. And we've learned a few pieces of information, but not that much, right? Basically, what we've learned is that if we're able to measure the power in scalar modes, then we learned something about the ratio of the energy scale during inflation to the Planck scale, but with this factor of epsilon, right? So I'm going to forget about all the pis and things like that. And we also learned that the only other prediction at the two-point level is if we could also measure primordial gravitational waves or tensor modes, then we would have learned something purely about the inflationary scale, because it's really this just goes as h squared over m Planck squared. And remember, epsilon was defined as the variation in h. So in some sense, what we've learned from all of this is something about h and something about h dot, if we believe this story so far. But what we'd really like is, you know, we want some way to test this framework in the most meaningful way possible. One of those tests is the idea that whatever is responsible for generating this homogeneous background is somehow simultaneously generating the perturbations. And so that comes into the fact that we need h dot to be not exactly constant. We think that it makes sense that, in fact, h dot should only have one particular sign. H should always decrease. And so the fact that when we parameterize this thing as delta squared is some amplitude and some running, the fact that we measure this thing to be slightly red tilted, slightly less than 1, we think is sort of encouraging, because this goes mostly like epsilon, also with some contribution from how epsilon varies. So that's sort of one non-trivial test, right? But that all of that is sort of independent of certainly particle physics as we know it. We never made any prescription for what the inflaton actually was. If we had, maybe we could have gotten, you know, a full potential for the inflaton, more terms than just a mass, for example. And we haven't really checked any sort of consistency with this perturbation theory expansion. So one of the things that's happening right now is that to try to go beyond this, either to try to really match this to some particular model, because lots and lots of models match it at this level, or to try to make non-trivial tests of the theory itself, people are going further in this perturbation theory expansion. So go beyond the amplitude of fluctuations. And that is this non-Gaussian. So we talked about yesterday how in a very clean way we can get all of this stuff in one go if we start expanding the action, right? If we start looking at the background, plus the stuff that's quadratic in the fluctuations, et cetera, et cetera. And so far, the check that we've done essentially has been that we have, right, observationally speaking, this number is really small. The amplitude of fluctuations is really small. So sort of the first non-trivial check that's consistent with is just that this term, the fluctuations, is very small compared to this term. So we know that that's true, because if we look, so I'm going to schematically evaluate these two terms, right? We saw yesterday that this is actually integral. There was an m Planck squared d4x. There was a cubed, which is the background root g. There was an epsilon. And there were terms like zeta dot squared. Okay. So we can easily estimate the size of this term compared to the size of this term, right? This term, essentially, the most important term is just the potential energy on the background, right? So the first check that we have is that this fluctuation term is actually small compared to the background. So in some sense, what this is amounting to is consistency of the fact that if I, let me write it as Lagrangian, so just because I'm going to ignore all the integrations and things like that, roughly the amplitude of this thing, the size of this thing over the size of this thing, is much, much less than 1. And we can just check that that's true, because this top part is m Planck squared epsilon. And if we do our trick of saying that derivatives are factors of h, there's an h squared. And then the thing that's left over is this zeta squared. We can sort of plug in the value, the amplitude of fluctuations that we got from here, right? Basically, the size of this is what's frozen at horizon crossing. That's the relevant thing. And this is the horizon crossing value. So this one. So we can basically just plug in for zeta squared this factor here, which is h squared over epsilon m Planck squared. And this, which is essentially just the potential energy, well, that's just by the first Einstein equation or the first Friedmann equation, that's just m Planck squared h squared up to the factor of 3. So basically what this is telling us is that h over m Planck is much, much less than 1. So that means that fluctuations are small. And that's also good, right? Because, in fact, these terms have the wrong equation of state. If these guys dominate, they're not only going to change the solution, but because there's a gradient term here, in fact, they'll probably stop inflation, right? It's not potential energy dominated anymore. So they have the wrong equation of state. So this is a good consistency check. And you can see that it doesn't tell us that much about our theory. It just tells us that the energy scale of inflation had better be below the Planck scale. But that's sort of what we would have taken as our basic criteria for writing down a reasonable theory anyway. Okay? But still, that's what we learned so far. Fluctuations are small, which is good. They don't dominate. They don't have a huge back reaction during inflation. And basically, that boils down to saying that the energy scale is below the Planck scale. OK. Sorry. Which line? Sorry, yeah, sorry. This is a time. This is a times. What I did is I took the epsilon, the h squared from the derivatives, and then was multiplying by the amplitude of zeta squared. Okay. So if we were stopping at the level of the 2-point, this would be basically all the information we needed for consistency of our theory, both with observation and sort of what's a physically reasonable criteria for how to write down inflation. Once we start going beyond that, we're really asking that we're doing perturbation theory, right? Just like in any particle physics sense. These are coming from interaction terms, and we want those interactions to be small, essentially. First, because we want the prediction that we've made for the power spectrum to genuinely come from the quadratic term in the action, right? If that's not true, if there's a big correction from this guy to this guy, then we have to revisit all of our analysis. The second reason that we think that has to be true is that measurements of these terms give a property that the statistics of the CMB or the density field of the universe are actually much different than we think they are. So you often hear the statement that basically the CMB, for example, is nearly Gaussian. So we're going to quantify what that means today. But basically what that means is that you can take, at this moment, what that means is essentially that these corrections can't be too large. So we're going to quantify what it means for these corrections not to be too large in a minute. So this means basically that we're doing what we need to check that perturbation theory is valid. And the question is then, if that's true, does that mean that there's any interesting signature here, no interesting signature, things like that? Okay. So what I'm going to start with is a very useful parameterization. Well, I'm going to spell that wrong, so let me just not write it down. This is a phenomenological, let's put it that way, phenomenological characterization of non-Gaussianity. And non-Gaussianity, I'm just going to call it NG. Okay. So really, I mean, really what we saw yesterday is that we have a particle physics model for what inflation is. Then we go through this exercise of doing the perturbation theory expansion. We write down the terms that are have three or more powers of the fluctuations. And we have a precise expression for what the prediction for, say, the three-point function is going to be. We work a little bit harder. We have the four-point, et cetera, et cetera. But that's a lot of work, and it depends to some extent on what you write down in the action here. So cosmologists, before any of this story was complete, they said, okay, what are we looking at? We're looking at statistics of the density field. We're looking at statistics of the CMB. What if that thing isn't Gaussian? What should we do? So without having to do all of this work, they made a very smart ansatz for what it might look like or how to include non-Gaussianity in the picture. And that ansatz, we'll talk a little bit about how it connects to particle physics models, but it's extremely useful to get some intuition of what non-Gaussianity means and what it means to be very non-Gaussian or not. And so this thing is the local ansatz. And it's also the origin of the parameter that you most commonly hear quoted when you hear people talk about constraints on non-Gaussianity. So over here, we had NS, We had a naught. We had this parameter r, which was the ratio of tensors to scalars. Sorry, I should be calling these deltas always. Right, and those r, n, s, maybe the variation of n, s with k, those are the things that people talk about when they talk about constraining the two-point. The sort of new parameter that comes in at this level, people often just call FNL. And where does that come from? Well, cosmologists said, okay, let me suppose that in real space, right, so they really have in mind maybe thinking about the density field in real space, let me suppose that the non-Gaussian field, well, we know it's essentially Gaussian, so let me start with something that's a Gaussian piece. And the easiest way to make that thing non-Gaussian is to add a contribution that goes like that Gaussian field squared, right? Now it's nonlinear in some sense. And so the coefficient is some coefficient that tells you how nonlinear this equation is. So that's FNL, F nonlinear. And then you have to subtract a piece, which is the expectation value of the field squared, to make sure that you still have mean zero here. Okay, so this thing guarantees, this is a Gaussian piece, this guarantees that phi non-Gaussian, phi is equal to zero. Because these are the fluctuations. And they're using phi because this is essentially the, it was really something called the Bardeen potential, which is built of these sort of gauge invariants that we talked about. But we can just think about it as the gravitational potential, the fluctuation in that. So let's call it delta gravitational potential, which is basically minus this zeta that we've been using, minus the curvature. Okay, yeah. No, sorry, this is a multiplication. This is a coefficient. It tells you how. All right, so this is extremely nice. And this goes back to a long time ago in, I think, the late 80s, Salopek and Bond. But then it was really sort of developed by David Spergel and Ichiro Komatsu in the context of the CMB. So they started using this to do analysis to check non-Gaussianity of the CMB, for example. OK, so this is really useful. So yeah.
When you wrote that the expectation value of the non-Gaussian piece is zero, or which is NG?
So this whole thing is the non-Gaussian thing. And basically before, if this was just a fluctuation, the mean was zero on both sides. But now if we add this piece to ensure the mean is zero, we have to.
And this is not scalar, so this is the gravitational potential.
Yeah, this they wrote for the gravitational potential. Now, you can make sort of, you know, transformations between all the variables we use, but let me use this one because that's what they did. Yeah, there's too many phis in this problem, right? So really, in some sense, this is a capital phi, which is Bardeen's potential, which is related to the gauge invariant thing, but I get tired of writing capital phi. Okay. All right. So why is this nice, basically? Well, the first reason it's nice is that it gives you a very concrete way of saying what size should this parameter be? What does FNL mean? How big should it be? So basically, how non-Gaussian? And the reason that that's easy to see is because we can just look at the two-point function of this thing, right? So let's look at phi non-Gaussian squared. So I'm going to be a little bit sloppy because I'm going to take the coincidence limit always here. So I'm just going to evaluate it at the same argument. And secretly, if I take a Fourier transform here, then this becomes a convolution. When it becomes a convolution, this piece actually matters. When you start taking the correlation functions, there are pieces in here that cancel with pieces in there, things like that. So you can work it out in detail. But I'm just going to show you what the result is that doesn't depend on, you know, you can see the result without actually doing the Fourier transform. Okay? If you do the Fourier transform, there's some pieces that cancel, but it doesn't matter. So let me write this down. You can see that this thing, of course, if I square this thing, the first contribution is just going to come from the Gaussian field squared. So we have this contribution phi Gaussian squared. There's a cross term, which would be phi Gaussian cubed, but we know that's zero, right? This is a Gaussian field, so the three-point of a Gaussian field should vanish. The next contribution comes from this thing squared. This thing squared goes like 4 powers of the Gaussian field, which goes like the 2-point squared. So the correction goes like FNL squared, and it goes like phi Gaussian squared squared with some factor of, you know, 3, I guess, from the way you can do the contractions. This is essentially Wick's theorem. Okay. So if I want the 2-point to be essentially given by the calculation that we did over here, right, by the quadratic field, the Gaussian field, then that means that this correction should be small. So basically, merely Gaussian means that FNL squared phi squared squared is much, much less than phi squared. This is always Gaussian in here. Or in other words, FNL phi Gaussian squared is much, much less than 1. So for the CMD, we know what the order of magnitude of this thing is, right? So there's some factor here that when I need to translate between the gravitational potential back to the curvature, but that factor is actually just a numerical factor that's pretty small. So for the CMB, we can read off from this that what we mean by nearly Gaussian is that FNL is much, much less than 1 over essentially delta zeta squared, and there's a factor of 3/5 here, it doesn't matter. And we know that this thing is essentially 10 to the 9 halves, right? Sorry, so this should just be FNL squared, yeah. So FNL basically has to be less than about 10 to the 5, okay, to be nearly Gaussian. Is that okay? Okay. Okay. So for the CMB, FNL less than 10 to the 5 means nearly Gaussian. So this is, yeah. So if it's the gravitational potential in real space, no. Now secretly I'm cheating a little bit because I need to take a Fourier transform and all of that, but what I mean just is that this is less than this, and if we take the gravitational potential, it's dimensionless. Yeah. So it's a bit of a cheater way, but it turns out that this constraint, FNL much, much less than 10 to the 5, which is literally true for this model, is actually an approximation to some extent, or it's the same thing in particle physics models as asking that S3 be smaller than S2 in the action, roughly. So let me just stop here for a minute. So this is the numerical value that when people say in their minds the CMB is very, very nearly Gaussian, it means we haven't measured FNL to be this big.
That's a huge number.
So currently, CMB says something like, and I can give you the precise numbers if you want, says something like FNL, whether it's positive or negative, is less than something like 60, 80. Okay? So the difference between 60 and 10 to the 5 is what people mean when they say the CMB is very, very Gaussian. Okay. But all that means, basically, is that this theory is weakly coupled, that it's perturbative, which isn't, you know, most of particle physics is perturbative, so that's not really saying a whole lot. So more formally, for the models that we've been talking about, a very similar constraint comes about from asking that if I evaluate the 2-point function for the full field, so this is, let's call it, again, phi not Gaussian, that's the 2-point that we calculated from S2. And in principle, you can have some corrections, right, which are just sort of like loop diagrams in particle physics. So if I have a 3-point interaction, that's going to give me a correction to the 2-point, and so on. Right? So basically, it's saying that this, all these corrections are small. And if you go through the formalism of how you actually compute those things, turns out that for many models, a good approximation to say, to demand that these things are small, turns out to be the same trick that we just did over there, to take, to ask essentially that L3, and in quotes what I mean is that I've taken the fields and I've evaluated them at their horizon crossing values, that this thing is small compared to L2 with fields evaluated at their horizon crossing values. Okay? Now, it's not, I mean, you might believe me that that's true, but it's not completely obvious why that works, right? Because after all, we quantize the field within the, you know, inside the space, and we got the horizon crossing value. And you actually need to go through and calculate these things where interactions happen at some set of times inside the horizon. But it turns out to work pretty well. So we can ask what that means, for example, for slow roll inflation. So for basically normal standard single field inflation, we had all of the apparatus on the board yesterday to figure out what the cubic term in the action was. Remember, I told you that as far as we expanded those quantities, that was as far as we needed to go, and we couldn't have written down what S3 was. So for standard single field, we basically did all the work. Not really, there's a bunch more algebra. We did all the work yesterday. And we found that we basically had, I just erased this, right, but we had S2 as in Planck squared d4x root g epsilon zeta dot squared. So now these are just going to be, for most of the term, this is the most important term. And there are a few terms that have the same order of magnitude. There are smaller terms. So let me just write proportional to the most important term. So if you had gone ahead and plugged in and asked what S3 was, you would have gotten M Planck squared minus G, two factors of epsilon, and then something like zeta dot squared. Okay. So now if I want to ask, well, let me ask that these things, the ratio of these things is small, what do I get? Well, here I've got M Planck squared, epsilon squared. I've got, again, two time derivatives, so let me write H squared. And then I've got the field itself cubed. So let me approximate that by the expectation value of zeta squared to the 3 halves, which is just going to be H over M Planck root epsilon cubed. And let me compare that to the size of this guy, right? Size of that guy, M Planck squared epsilon H squared, H over M Planck root epsilon squared. Okay? So you can see that I've got, let's see, so I've got how many powers of epsilon? 1, 2, 3 and a half. 1, 2. Let's see, is that right? So I've got, this is in the denominator, right? So there's one whole factor of epsilon, which cancels one whole factor here. So here I've got epsilon to the 1 minus a half, so minus a half. Is that right? And on the bottom I've got epsilon divided by epsilon, which is just epsilon to the minus a half. Is that right? Nope, should be, sorry, plus. Yeah, I was canceling this one twice, right? Let's cancel this one with this one, one of these with one of these, half of these with half of that, epsilon to the 1/2, Planck squareds, H squareds. So then I'm left over with, again, a factor of H, and again a factor of M Planck. And I wanted that thing to be small. A more informative way of writing this is to divide by both sides, divide on both sides by a factor of epsilon. Because then I'm going to have that H over M Planck root epsilon is much, much less than 1 over epsilon. And this is essentially the power spectrum, right? The amplitude of fluctuations. So this tells me that this thing we've been calling delta squared should be less than 1 over epsilon squared. Epsilon is a number less than 1, tells me this thing less than 1. you can see that in this case, the fact that the fluctuations are small, right, means that it's completely consistent with Gaussianity. Right? So basically, this quantity here is a number bigger than 1, and we've already verified that this quantity is much smaller than 1. Okay? So in that sense, single field slow roll is very Gaussian. And in fact, you can be more precise about that. And this was, to a large extent, the point of that paper by Maldacena that we talked about yesterday, that we've sort of that set up all this formalism. And so we can ask, basically, well, for single field slow roll, what is FNL? How big? How non-Gaussian can it be? Can already guess that it's going to be pretty Gaussian. Well, it turns out that, I need to introduce one thing first. When I wrote down, so just like the power spectrum is the Fourier transform of the real point, the real space two-point function, we can ask about the bispectrum, which is the Fourier transform of the real space three-point function. So this is something like zeta k1, zeta k2, zeta k3. Okay. And you can argue what that has to look like in a similar way that we argued sort of what the power spectrum has to look like, right? When we wrote down this phenomenological ansatz for the two-point function, what did we do? Well, okay, there's always some 2 pi's floating around, the Fourier conventions. Just like in the two-point function, there was a delta function of momentum. Here there's also a delta function of momentum, right? Again, we think if I'm looking at the real space three-point function, I arrange 3 points on the sky, doesn't matter how I orient them, where they are, I should get the same answer. So the only thing that matters is the relative distances between those. Or in Fourier space, we say there's a delta function of the sum of the momenta. And everything else that's left over goes by the name of B for bispectrum. And that's a function of k1, k2, k3, in principle, subject to that constraint. And if you want, you can take out, again, the factors of k that have to be there, right, to get the whole thing, to get a dimensionless version of the bispectrum. But it's a little bit trickier because there are actually a couple ratios of k here, right? But if you took the local ansatz and took the Fourier transform of that, you could write down very easily what the three-point function is, right? And you would have found that this thing, k1, k2, k3. Well, remember, if I took the three-point function, sorry, I erased it, it was here, I would have had 3 copies of the non-Gaussian field. The lowest order way, the lowest order in FNL to do that is to take 2 copies of the Gaussian thing, 1 copy of the non-Gaussian thing. So that was proportional to FNL. And then remember, we would have the field, the Gaussian field to the fourth, which again is 2 copies of the power spectrum, right? So basically, what that tells us is that what comes in here is delta phi, but it turns out to be roughly the same thing, of, let's say, k1. Sorry, this is really p now, because the k's are in there. P of k1, p of k2. So this goes like 1 over k1 cubed, 1 over k2 cubed, plus all the symmetric combinations. There's really a factor of 2, but and this is, if you look at this bispectrum, it's not just an amplitude with maybe some scaling, right? It's actually a triangle because of this delta function. So in general, you can draw triangles for the different forms of the bispectra. And it turns out that this triangle is largest in the squeeze limit. Where you take 2 of the momenta to be nearly equal and 1 to be much shorter, much smaller, k1, k2. Okay? So there's a very long wavelength mode, and then there's 2 short wavelength modes, and you're correlating those. Okay. So the reason I went through this is that it turns out that you can ask for the slow roll case, you can write down S3 exactly. You can write down the full function of K that is the bispectrum for slow roll. But again, it turns out to be something that's roughly largest in this squeezed limit. So if you want to ask what FNL is, to a large extent, you know, again, it's some not exact mapping between the local quantity, local model quantity, and this quantity. But if you take the squeeze limit, then you can make the mapping more precise. And you can try to ask in single field slow roll, if I think about what happens in the correlation between a long wavelength mode, K3, and two short wavelength modes, how big can that correlation be? So in slow roll inflation, sorry, let me write that out. How big is the correlation between K3, long wavelength, and K1 approximately equal to K2, short wavelength? Okay, well, we know the answer because we can go back to the picture we always draw. A nearly flat potential and then some end to inflation. The long wavelength mode, K3, exits early, right? Long wavelength modes exit earlier than short wavelength modes, or they freeze out earlier. So let's say here's the scale for K3 is AH. And the short wavelength modes exit much later, right? So that's going to be some point over here. K2 is K1 is AH. But a fluctuation here, what does a fluctuation here do? It basically shifts the field back and forth on the potential. It shifts the clock. So if you like, if I had an early fluctuation here, it slightly resets the clock or the time for fluctuations that exit here. There are two of them that exit here, so we can just ask about the two-point function of these guys and how it shifted, thanks to the fluctuation here. Well, if this potential was exactly flat, wouldn't do anything, right? There's no meaning to those positions and those shifts of position. Exactly, so let's just say K3 fluctuation shifts, if you like, the clock for what's essentially the two-point function of the short wavelength mode. K1, K2 doesn't matter. That shift is meaningless if the potential is exactly flat. So the strength of the correlation between those modes, which is basically FNL, can only go like the deviation from flatness. Deviation from flatness is parameterized by the spectral index, -1. So it's not actually an equal, it's an approximate sign. You can work out what it is, but essentially it's -1. And in slow roll, we'd measured this, right, in the CMB. This is a really small number. This is basically something like 0.04, okay? So you can see that what slow roll predicts is very, very, very far from what would be very non-Gaussian, right, which would be FNL of 10 to the 5. Uh-huh. Yeah. 2-point at that, that exits here. Yeah. So the situation that we have basically is that we have this number, you know, 0.04, which is much, much, much less than the current constraint, something that's order 60, which is much, much less than this 10 to the 9 halves number. And basically, the reason that this number was so small is that the interactions that are present, if they're just coming from the flatness of that potential, they have to be extremely weak, right? So basically, flat potential implies very weak interactions. And so, you know, we sort of visually had in mind the self-interactions of the field, which were controlling the slope of that potential. But actually, what's important here, if you work it out, is actually also a gravitational interaction, but gravity is very weak also, right? So of course this interaction is small. So that's the dominant thing. The potential is very flat. Slow roll gives you a really small number. Okay. But you can see there's a lot of space in between here and here, and this thing is still weakly coupled, right? So there could be a lot of physics in here. So the other interesting number that sits in between these two values is a number of order 1, or of order something like 5, actually. And this number is interesting because, first of all, this is the sort of the potential for constraints from the Planck satellite. Which is up, which is running, which looks good, and which should release its cosmological data in a couple years. So you can see that what that means is an observation of non-Gaussianity by Planck rules out very definitively standard, and I'll tell you what standard means in a minute, standard single field slow roll. And standard basically means that we didn't do anything weird to the initial state. And it's legitimately single field, and it's legitimately flat potential. So standard, so this means Bunch-Davies initial state, and it means canonical kinetic term. The second reason that this is interesting is that, you know, we've sort of we haven't really talked about how to map the curvature fluctuations into the actual CMB measurements. There is some non-trivial evolution, just gravitational evolution of those things, right? Once they re-enter the horizon and go through some processing, essentially, to get turned into the CMB. So this is also the level. It's a very hard calculation to get this exactly, to get an exact prediction. In fact, it's a calculation that in some ways is testing GR. But this number of order 5 or a few is also the level expected just from nonlinear, if you like, post-processing or evolution of these modes, nonlinear evolution of modes post-inflation. And that's really just gravity. Right? Gravity is nonlinear. So actually it generates non-Gaussianity as things progress. Okay. So the point about the bispectrum here is that the way that people get constraints in the CMB is actually to take some prescription for what this triangle is, right? So the precise version of this constraint for the so-called FNL parameter actually depends a little bit on what the detailed physics is. And that detailed physics is more properly encoded in the shape of this triangle. So C and B constraints come from basically looking at templates for a particular bispectra. And people often define, it's not a particularly good definition, but people often do it. They often define something that's sort of an equivalent FNL from looking at the equilateral limit, right? You have a bunch of k's here in the bispectrum. But, you know, kind of a stupid thing you can do to get out one number from that is to take the equilateral limit, so there's just one k everywhere. And then you can divide out by that power spectrum squared, right? Because in the local ansatz, that was literally the FNL number. So you can do a similar thing no matter what your bispectrum is, and you can sort of define FNL that way. It's not a particularly good definition because you've lost all information, you've lost important information about how the shapes vary. So there are alternative definitions which are better, but this roughly is something you can keep in mind. And the CMB so far has constrained, so using this method, you can get constraints on FNL, what you call FNL, for equilateral triangles, for example. Of course, this squeeze triangle. And there's another one that's common that is folded, where basically you push down the center here, so K1 is approximately equal to K2 is each half of K3, if you like, folded. Okay. So why these, and what's the point of these? Well, basically, these different types of triangles encode for you qualitatively different physics of what's going on back in that original action and particle physics picture. So, for example, equilateral type non-Gaussianity is what comes from having derivative interactions. Derivative. So basically, if I took the action, and instead of just writing down basically g mu nu, d mu phi, d nu phi, I could have added that quantity squared, for example, as long as I scaled it out by the appropriate some mass, dot, dot, dot. And you can see that these interactions are perfectly fine from the point of inflation because they have a shift symmetry, right? If I take phi goes to phi plus constant, this guy doesn't change. So nothing about adding these interactions is going to spoil for you inflation, the whole inflationary story. We needed a flat potential to get enough inflation. This doesn't stop that from happening. But it is a new interaction, right? And depending on how big this sort of kinetic energy is compared to this scale m, it can be significant. This, in fact, was a very interesting model that came out of string theory that people got very excited about because there's a very special form of summing up these interactions which gives you a huge non-Gaussianity, which would be extremely exciting, right? Because in some ways it was one of the first ways that people thought of to get a large non-Gaussianity. For a long time people said non-Gaussianity is of order n s minus 1, never going to see it, let's not worry about it. And that's true in simple models, but it's certainly not true once you look at more interesting things. So equilateral triangles were constrained because of derivative interactions. Yeah? No, so these were actually just terms in the DBI action for a D-brain. So the squeeze triangle we already saw, this was sort of the famous local ansatz. So of course people want to constrain that because that seems very natural. Where does it come from? Local, fine, that's great. Where does it actually come from in particle physics? Well, it comes from scenarios with multiple fields. So this little story that I just told you about the correlation in the local modes doesn't go through if I have more than one field. Basically, if you have more than one field, then it's no longer true that this zeta mode is exactly constant outside the horizon. So it's no longer true that the only thing that can happen is that you effectively shift the clock. So if you somehow have more fields in the problem, either so that you distinguish the flatness of the potential, which is giving you your background sufficient inflation, from the thing that's generating the fluctuations, if you separate those two things, then the thing that's generating the fluctuations can be more strongly coupled, if you like. You can have bigger interactions. And also, the mode that's the curvature mode can evolve outside the horizon. And in some scenarios, the longer it's outside the horizon, you know, the more it evolves and the more it can move away from that exact Gaussianity that was sort of imposed by the potential. So multiple fields break that, and multiple fields look, it turns out, give something that, that's essentially dominant in the squeeze limit. Another thing that, that you can get, so it turns out that, that in DBI, this, you know, the, sorry, I shouldn't, so in the string theory model, the derivative interactions that came out were of a very particular form, because you had a very particular symmetry that was telling you exactly what terms could appear there. If you instead just ask, what are the possible shapes of non-Gaussianity that I could get from generic derivative interactions, turns out there are more things than just the equilateral, and one of them is folded. So this is can come from sort of different derivative interactions. And it can also come, and it's not, there are other things that can be generated this way too, but it can also be generated by having a different initial state from Bunch-Davies. So part of the statement about Gaussianity was that you know how we had set up our initial state of how each mode was populated and how each mode was compared to the other modes. If you change that and you sort of let that evolve, often thanks, you know, in addition to having some interaction term there that mixes up all that, you can again generate non-Gaussianity. So this is also from initial state, changing the initial state. So what's great about this is that you don't have to be precise, right? We're not looking so. So the problem with the spectral index and variations of the spectral index is that if you want to ask, you know, what's the third derivative of the potential, you have to get more and more and more precise about how you measure the spectral index. And that's really hard because the CMB sees a finite range of the inflationary potential. Here we've got a completely independent orthogonal statistic, right, whose qualitative properties, before you get down to the precise number, whose qualitative properties are distinguishing physics that looked identical at the two-point level and qualitatively different physics. So that's why people are so excited, right? Because this, this is so much more meaningful and it contains so much more information. This is just the three-point, and already the three-point is a triangle, right? Four-point, et cetera, of course, is more information. Of course, you think they might be smaller, but still. So this is why Gaussianity is exciting. Okay, any questions so far? So the other reason that this is great, that this is interesting, is that the CMB, you know, has been the most fantastic thing for cosmology in a long time. And it's the origin of these very precise measurements of statistics that gave us the two-point, and it's currently giving these constraints on the three-point. However, Planck is the satellite that's up and running. There's no other satellite sort of on the horizon. You know, there are speculative ideas, but there's nothing that's going to happen within a decade, right? So after 2013, what are we going to do with the CMB, right? We're done. If we see something, we don't, we don't. And in some sense, we're done. We also know, you know, there are hard calculations to get, for example, this nonlinear term exactly right, but we also know the physics that's going into the CMB. It's known astrophysics, and even, you know, the corrections to that are essentially, you know, again, known particle physics, atomic physics, things like that. So we know the CMB, we know the physics that's there, and it's coming to an end, at least for, you know, the foreseeable short-term future. So the interesting thing is that we're not done, of course, because there are a whole bunch of other correlated observables that also came from these initial conditions, right? And those observables have to do with the pattern of large-scale structure, with actually what happens to the matter field. This is the photon field to a large extent, but what happens to the matter field, the dark matter and the baryons after that. So beyond the CMB, there's a remarkable set of data that's going to come in from large-scale structure. And what's nice about this is that it's a bunch of unknown physics, for one thing. So the part that we're after, of course, with inflation are the initial conditions. But all kinds of interesting things happen because, and it's nonlinear. So interesting things happen because it's nonlinear, but also because, of course, you know, how structure forms and when it forms and in detail depends on everything else that's there besides the initial conditions. So it certainly depends on, for example, when dark energy is relevant and what the dark energy equation of state is, maybe, if you like. You know, it depends to some extent, although the stuff we compute so far is relatively insensitive to details, but eventually it does depend on what's going on with dark matter. And it depends on how, basically, we learn to map, you know, the stuff that we actually observe, which is either luminous matter, gravitational potentials, right? We don't directly observe the dark matter itself. So how to map observables. Back to the initial conditions, and in particular, how to map observables even into the dark matter distribution. Okay. So the other reason that this is nice, basically, is that it's complementary information, but it's very different information from the CMB. So, for example, it can probe smaller scales. So the CMB sees, you know, some range of e-folds, some few e-folds, 10 e-folds of inflation. We think there's more. Some types of large-scale structure observations can actually probe further down the potential, so they can probe to different scales. So it could be that even if you don't see anything in the CMB, there's still something that's there, some interaction term that you can only see through large-scale structure. So maybe CMB sees nothing. This information is so important that nobody's going to stop there, basically, right? Because this is the only way we have to get more information about inflation at the moment is to look for higher order statistics. So that people are going to continue doing that. And it's not completely implausible that there's something there that the CMB doesn't see. Basically, the same thing that's causing the power spectrum to evolve, right? There's some spectral index, so power decreases on small scales. Could definitely be there in the interaction as well. So if things are evolving during inflation, the strength of the interaction could be evolving during inflation, and you could see something at small scales that you don't see on large scales. And that was another actually nice feature of this string theory model, was that it had, again from the same symmetry that was giving you these terms, it had a very definite prescription for how non-Gaussianity evolved, and the interactions were becoming stronger on smaller scales. So that was a very interesting feature that prompted people again to go back and say, okay, let's consider large scale structures separate from CMB. And the other thing is that because it's nonlinear, the place where observables show up can be sort of surprising. So as long as things remain essentially linear, if I want to look for the three-point, I better look at the three-point, right? I better do this prescription for the bispectrum, run it through the data, and see what I get. But because the structure is nonlinear, signatures can show up. Basically, non-Gaussianity can show up even in the power spectrum, or the two-point, of objects. So things like, you know, galaxies are nonlinear objects, right? The gravitational field has bound those objects together, so they're certainly not linear perturbations anymore. So any sort of bound object behaves differently than the underlying linear field, power spectrum of, say, galaxies. And interestingly, this is the source of the only constraint on non-Gaussianity that is so far competitive with the CMB constraint. It's actually from power spectrum of galaxies. Because that same, and it comes for this local model, the same correlation of a long wavelength background mode with short wavelength modes essentially changes the physics that tells you how many objects form in a particular local region. So this, comparing the power spectrum of dark matter halos, so this is a two-point correlation of halos, so halo-halo, and comparing how that is so proportionally to the two-point function of the linear matter field. There's a proportionality constant there, which is true even whether things are Gaussian or not. But if things are non-Gaussian, so in general it depends on the mass of the object, if things are non-Gaussian, then it depends on the strength of the coupling, of the correlation between long wavelength modes and short wavelength modes. And it can also be a function of scale. So if we come back here, this constraint is from the CMB, and it's for a variety of models. again by this sort of template method of running bispector through the CMB. But there's a comparable constraint for the local model from CMB, from large scale structure for the local model, local ansatz, which is coming from this coefficient B, which is called the bias. So we call it halo bias. Just looking at how the power spectrum of objects has changed. And the other thing that's great about this is that we've barely measured anything so far. So you've probably seen these fantastic pictures from like Sloan Digital Sky Survey, right? Where they show you the movie, you zoom out, there's all these galaxies, it's fantastic, fantastic. What Sloan has so far is a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of these statistics that we expect in the future. So for example, if something like LSST, which Chris Stubbs talked about in the colloquium yesterday, if something like LSST comes about, we're going to have a phenomenal amount of data. What we need are just masses and redshifts of objects. And so all of that data is going to allow us to do much, much better statistics of all kinds of stuff, even than we can do with the CMB right now. So this is really, really an exciting future. And finally, let me just say that there's one other point about all this, which is that if you know what model you want, you can write a prescription for the bispectrum, right? You can write a template for that you can compare the data with some reasonable chance of success. But there are too many triangles, let alone four-point endpoint functions, that you can be measured to actually just go and measure them all and say, what is the three-point function in the CMB? So if you want to check for non-Gaussianity in a way that's not sort of case-by-case basis, you want to look at some different statistic besides these guys. Okay, that's fine. Of course, there are a zillion statistics that tell you if something's Gaussian or non-Gaussian. But some of them are especially sort of transparent. So, but not precisely model independent, but let's say less model dependent. And these are statistics other than endpoint functions. So one that's extremely easy to see what it means. So there are others that you can do in the CMB. There are lots of these kinds of statistics. But just for example, if you count the number of very large objects, that's telling you something about the actual distribution. So now what I'm going to draw is just a distribution, say, of density fluctuations. And so let's call this probability of, so delta, let's think of the density. And of course, my drawing skills are not going to be fantastic. Let's pretend, okay? Let's pretend that this is Gaussian. And let me then try to add a curve which is non-Gaussian. So very massive objects are generated from large fluctuations in the initial density field, right? A very initially overdense region is going to collapse into a bigger object, essentially. So if I look out here, basically large objects and galaxy clusters are the largest bound objects that we can think of, those guys come from the tail of the distribution. So if you have something that's non-Gaussian, and the tail of the distribution is very different, you expect a different number of very large objects. So if you actually take that local ansatz, you can do an exact change of variable, and you can draw these curves for yourself. And the convention is such that if FNL is positive, that's a positively skewed term curve, which means that the positive tail, you know, the side of positive fluctuations is lifted. This is FNL greater than 0. And that just predicts that you're going to have more very large structure. So if you look at the most massive clusters, or if you look at the highest redshifts, right, because things that are bigger earlier are also from further out on the tail, so very high mass, very high redshift stuff, you might think that that's some signature of non-Gaussianity if that's there. And in fact, one of the curves that that was shown in the colloquium yesterday was actually a constraint on non-Gaussianity from when he was talking about very large clusters, although he didn't say it. And it was basically talking about the fact that people have identified a few objects that look very surprising. And they've tried to make claims based on those few objects about whether things are non-Gauss, whether there's evidence for non-Gaussianity. But it's very hard to do that, right? There are statistical reasons it's hard to do that, because you have one object and you looked in a finite volume, so how on earth do you figure out how many objects you should have seen or didn't see based on that? And it's also hard to do because if all you did was calculate the three-point function, it's easy to get yourself out in a regime far enough on the tail where actually you needed to have computed the higher order moments to say anything concrete, right? This is an integration over all the moments. So, you know, depending on how important you think the various moments are, there's some regime where, sure, it's the three-point that matters the most, but the farther out you go, the more those other moments matter. And so there's also a mathematical reason that it's hard to make a precise statement here. So one of the plots, one of the things that has happened is that as people get better statistics on clusters, it's easier to say what those numbers actually mean. And so at the moment, there are a few very unusual objects out there, but it's not clear what they mean, and it's not clear that they're evidence for anything being non-Gaussian. But of course, the level that we're testing non-Gaussianity is still, you know, pretty far from being conclusive that there's nothing interesting there. So, okay. So I guess I'll stop there. Thanks.